on the Empire Podcast this week, we've got the touch, we've got the look. This is right, Stanley Tucci, for it is he, pops in to talk about his new movie, Final Portrait. All that and more on the movie podcast that features very fine people on both sides. Very fine people. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, which this week is once again sponsored by those lovable peeps at Sky Atlantic, whose new original revenge thriller, Tin Star, starring Tim Roth, and Christina Hendricks, will be coming to your screens from September 7th. Monday, September 7th. You can either binge all the episodes at once like a greedy Gus, or you can wait for your weekly fix. It's entirely up to you. Or binge a couple and then wait a week for the next one. It's entirely up to you. But remember that crucial date. September 7th, Sky Atlantic, Tin Star, Tim Roth. There we go. Right. Now that's done and dusted, it's time to welcome this week's colleagues of such lethal cunning. Two of them, in fact. We've lost Phil to a back injury this week. So first up is our resident geek queen, a lady who... In fact, I was going to give you an intro about Hamilton, but you've just run another marathon, haven't you, Helen O'Hara? What? Come on.
Yeah, it was number 5. Salisbury 54321, highly recommended. As races go, they're lovely. They give you cake halfway through if you're getting
a bit tired. That's not a marathon.
It is.
That's a bake-off.
It's a trail marathon with a bake-off in it.
Trail mix marathon, more like.
Well, yes, though, that comes in handy too.
Oh, my word.
Hey.
Why do you run the marathons?
I mean, run is a really strong word for what I do, first of all.
What's your time?
Let's never speak of it. But it was, it's lovely. It's a beautiful course. I met some very nice people. I got talking to a lady who was also Northern Irish, and then it turned out she'd done 283 marathons.
I've done 283 marathons, so I have.
Yeah, so I didn't like her anymore. I'm kidding. She was awesome.
She's lovely. She's lovely.
Yes.
My aunt, I believe. Is this right? Probably. Well done on that. I am going to New York in December.
Hooray!
So, any advice on how to get Hamilton tickets? Which was your original intro.
You have two kidneys. Do you really need them both?
Well, the thing is, I'm going to see it twice in London.
Yeah.
So, do I need to see it in America?
And
I'm
it's not
so sure.
The original cast anymore, so maybe.
This is my thing. It's like, I'm going to the States for a few days with my wife, and, I thought, should we go see some shows, and they're really expensive, and what do you want to see? I did want to see The Play That Goes Wrong with the original British cast, but now they're swapping out in September, and it'll be a bunch of Americans doing terrible English accents, and I don't really want to do that.
Maybe they'll be great English accents.
Maybe they'll be great, but it just won't be the same.
You could go see
Groundhog
something
Day with Andy Carroll.
Except it's finishing in New York and coming back to London.
No! When?
It's finishing in, September, October, something like that. But it's coming back to London. I was devastated by this news, and then I was very pleased that we get it. And if they don't appreciate it, to hell with them.
It hasn't caught on in the States.
No.
At all, the way that I was expecting it to, because it's a thing of wonder.
It is.
Hello, James Dyer. Should I introduce you to the podcast at some point?
Nah, don't bother.
Oh, are you all right?
Hi, Chris. It's nice to be welcomed and wanted.
I had an intro, but...
Can't bother.
Yeah. You haven't run a marathon this week, have you?
I have never run a marathon. Ever. I don't see it happening either unless someone chases me, if I'm honest with you.
For 26.2 miles.
They'd have to really want to catch me.
But not so much that they like sprint at any point.
Yeah, they'd be pacing themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be like a shit Terminator.
You're a big fan of The West Wing, aren't you?
You've mentioned it once or twice.
Yeah. Is it entirely realistic, The West Wing? Is there an episode in The West Wing where the president refuses to, criticise Nazis?
That does, in fact, no, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Were you impressed that last week when I interviewed Al Gore, I basically talked climate change with him for 20 minutes just as a sort of warm-up so that I could drop a West Wing question at the end?
That's assumed that I listened to that interview.
Let's assume that, yeah.
I've listened to the interview, obviously, but the dozens of listeners to this podcast won't have listened to it. They'll have just skipped right through it.
Of course,
to get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
They go, where's the Jim Robin impressions? I don't want this Al Gore business. What was the question for the people who didn't listen to that interview?
Well, it doesn't really matter because I asked him a question about the West Wing and he did a masterful pivot back to climate change as if that's somehow a more worthy topic of conversation. And I was quite put out.
I mean, that makes no sense.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, you can get revenge on you review an inconvenient sequel later on in the podcast.
No, I just went home and turned on all the lights and started, Like, fuck you, Al Gore.
Immediately took a flight. The longest flight I could take.
Just called up BA. Where's that? Well, can I go round the globe a couple of times? Just circle it.
Yeah, and then just spray an aerosol
can. You are terrible people, both of you.
Yeah.
Having said that, I just started rewatching The West Wing last night, which was fun, because the first episode is just one for the ages.
How are you not doing what I'm doing, which is rewatching it along with The West Wing Weekly podcast?
Well, I started listening to The West Wing Weekly podcast last year when I was training for my other thing, and it reminded me how much I loved it, but at the time I was doing too many other things to start rewatching. So now what I'm doing is being really annoying and watching it with my sister and explaining to her all the things I learned from The West Wing Weekly.
Wow.
So it must be really fun for her.
Yeah, Helen-splaining The West Wing to her.
I am Helen-splaining The West Wing.
Dear God in heaven.
Right, shall we have a question?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. The question is from... Who's it from? It's from at Dan Burden, 1138. Not his real name, I'm guessing. And he asks, and it's really simple, very, very simple, favourite Nick Cage hairstyle?
Well, I think Nicolas Cage's best hairstyle has got to be The Rock. Done.
The Rock?
Let's move on.
The Rock?
Yeah, no,
you mean Con Air.
Con Air.
Con Air.
Cameron
Poe. That's a terrible hairstyle.
Yeah, that's why it's available.
Yes, but
no.
Nicolas Cage should always have terrible hair. That's just the way it is.
She's not wrong.
Well, it is the way of the world, and there's not much he can do about it, although he's tried over the years. But, oh no, I'm not having Con Air.
I mean, what are we saying? Like, favourite as in, were you Nick Cage, this is what you would wear to work? Is it favourite as in, most entertaining? So, like, are we talking like, you know, the kind of receding fro he has in Adaptation? That kind of,
Yeah. That sort of fuzziness, the fuzzy perm.
Yeah.
Fuzzy fading perm in pretty Adaptation. Good. But that's not something you'd want to sport, or indeed that he would want to sport. But he's settled on a hairstyle recently, hasn't he? He really, you know, he's chopped and changed over the years. He's a man who's prepared to dye his hair and to cut his hair and to do all sorts of terrible things to his hair. And maybe that's taken its toll over the years on his hair. So maybe this is why he's, of the last few films, he has seems to have settled on largely the same cut, the same colour, the same everything.
I guess. Has he?
Yeah.
Okay.
And all those terrible direct-to-video action movies that he's doing.
It's possible I've missed some.
It's all the same film, Helen.
Yes, that's why.
Yeah, you should watch them. They're really terrible.
Peggy Sue Got Married is a pretty fantastic one.
Uh-huh.
Was that his quiff period?
It was. I mean, it's got volume. It has volume. There's I mean, you know, it's a Nicky Clark wet dream, that whole thing.
So it's the 80s, basically.
Well, didn't you that kind of? He had a highlighted, sort of side swept little thing in that Valley Girl film that he did,
right? Yeah.
He's sported the kind of long mullet esque type thing on a number of occasions. What's he wearing there? What's that one that we saw? The magic-y one with wizards.
The magic-y one.
The magic-y one.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Was it that one?
Yeah, that's the magic-y one with wizards. Oh, do you mean Season of the Witch?
It might have been Season of the Witch. Yeah. He looked fairly stupid in that.
Yeah. It's a bit of a shame. He can be all over the place hair-wise. Raised in Arizona, he's got quite bad hair in that as well. Look at this. There's a film called Arsenal in this country. He plays a character called Eddie King. Look at that. It is a kind of weird... I think that's obviously meant to be a wig on the character.
It's a Jason Schwartzman sort of a look
Yes, it is. And of course, Jason Schwartzman is what? His nephew? His cousin? What is he, a nephew?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So he's gone to Jason. He's gone, look, mate, can I borrow your hair for the weekend? And Jason Schwartzman's gone, it's actually my hair, uncle. Please leave me alone. Stop. Oh, God. Please. No, God. And then he's got the hair and there you go.
You know that kind of back swept, long, you know, Vincent Vega meets Travolta in Swordfish kind of look?
Yeah.
He has that in Bangkok Dangerous. That's pretty, pretty excellent. Sort of pitch black dye job.
Ooh.
It's quite special.
It's a great name for a band. Pitch black dye job. So we're going for the favourite Nicolas Cage hair. Helen's already said Con Air.
It is Con Air.
You think it's Con Air?
It's Con Air.
I think that hair is a crime against tonsorial elegance.
It's really awful. Yeah.
We are in agreement about that.
Mm. Nobody's arguing.
But why is it a good thing?
Well, because he's never had good hair, so you're picking the most outrageously bad hair.
Yeah.
That hair nearly derails that film.
Well, you've got, okay, so Ghost Rider hair is fairly standard, but it's so obviously a sentient wig that, you know... It kind of there's no one talking about it.
What are you saying?
I'm saying it probably was co-billed.
I'm not sure I'm prepared to say that on the air. But what about his Gone in 60 Seconds hair? Right? Okay, that's pretty good hair. He's got the kind of slick back hair, a bit dyed blonde. No,
I guess.
No.
But it pales in comparison to Angelina Jolie's horrendous hair in that film.
Amazing platinum weave that she has.
Platinum dreads, almost, like it's massive, not a good not a good look for anybody.
Same hair as Charlize Theron in Fast and Furious 8. Mm. Pretty much, isn't it?
It's not. Yeah, it's not a million miles.
Proto Khaleesi.
Yeah. The thing is, you know, I don't know. Kiss of Death. He's got some sort of weird kind of side parting thing going on. It could happen to you. Red Rock West, Honeymoon in Vegas, Sandali got that pitch black Sandali
with the little chin fuzz.
Yeah. Mm. Wild at Heart, he's got pretty good hair in Wild at Heart, right? Pretty cool.
It's just another quiff.
Yeah, but it's cool quiff.
I mean, it's just like him doing Elvis,
I can't have Con Air. I can't. I feel I'm being unfooted in this one.
I've just looked up Deadfall, and one caption writer has described his haircut in Deadfall as casual Hitler. So that's something we should all aspire to.
There we go. Very fine people on both
sides. I mean, Knowing is another nadir, isn't it?
Great film, though.
Yeah, very underrated.
You guys genuinely think that?
Yeah. Underrated. I'm not saying necessarily.
Can we form a club after the podcast is over?
Knowing rules.
The Knowing Club. Yeah, that's good. Excellent. All right. Okay, so officially, I've been overruled in this. I think it's hair that nearly derails the film. Con Air is a masterpiece, as we all know. But the hair is so terrible. And I want to know what the thinking was behind the hair. I know Cameron Poe has been in prison, but they have barbers in prison, right? Or they at least have access to stabbing implements that you could use to cut your hair with. And
they have access to stabbing implements that you could use to cut your hair with.
Yeah.
Just, I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
On the prison system.
Uh-huh.
But I think certainly the ideal...
the syntax of my sentences.
Is that they do not have stabbing implements.
I think they do.
Circulating.
I'm pretty sure I've seen the odd film where people get, you know, they get that special prison hug, don't they?
Where, and a sharpened toothbrush.
I really like you! And then they just...
I don't think like sharpened toothbrushes, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, are that great for haircutting.
I don't know. I think if you get the hair, you get the hair. Because he says at the end, he says, I meant to get my hair cut, right? So clearly he was meant to go to the prison barbers and they all have sharpened toothbrushes.
But maybe the prison barber is famously bad and he was planning to get his hair cut on the outside, which would certainly explain his decision not to get his hair cut before getting on the plane.
Whatever, Helen. Whatever. All right. I think you've won this round. But we'll see if you win the next round. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can, of course, do so. Via a number of methods, you can use Twitter, as Dan Burton did with that thought-provoking question. Thanks, Dan. And we're on Twitter as at Emperor Magazine, and you can use the hashtag Emperor Podcast, and that'll help us see the question. We're on Facebook as Emperor Magazine, and you can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, so it is time for some movie news. Okay, so it's time now for some movie news. What has been happening in the world of the movies? I guess the big news this week?
Bondage. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's happening. Human Bondage. I mean, what a film.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean James.
Yeah. Helen, it's as a diehard fan of the franchise.
Super
perhaps,
fan.
Perhaps its biggest. Would you like to tell us about this?
Daniel Craig, in the world's least surprising news ever, is confirmed to return as James Bond. Although, he did lie about this less than 3 hours before confirming it.
Yeah.
So you've got to be impressed at his commitment to not confirming it until he was on American national television.
Almost as if he were a spy. And he wouldn't give up the information. I have to say, I would feel mightily miffed if I'd been one of the journalists who'd been interviewing Daniel Craig the other day.
He was talking about Logan Lucky, obviously, his new film.
Yes.
Soderbergh.
And obviously every journalist who went into the room talked to him. Was he in New York? Is Colbert Stephen? So he revealed the news to Stephen Colbert on The Late Show. And is Colbert now in New York or LA?
I don't care.
Wherever he is, he's in New York. That's just say. So every journalist who went into the room with Daniel Craig obviously went in going, so, Bond 25, are you doing it? And he went, look over there, a blue car. And basically lied to them. Didn't lie to them, but just...
No, he did lie. He basically said, talks are ongoing, no decisions have been made.
Yeah, but that's not a lie.
Which is a lie.
That's not a lie.
No decisions have been made.
No decisions have been made. How do we know he didn't make a decision in the last 3 hours?
Yeah, okay, sure.
He was being economical with the truth, yeah. I would say. That, yeah. I wouldn't say he was outright lying. He didn't say, for example, I'm not doing Bond 25, and then 3 hours later, said to Stephen Colbert.
That's
because
true.
Stephen Colbert is apparently a priest and you can only speak the truth to.
As our lawyer, we would like to make clear that Daniel Craig was not definitely lying. He may have been economical with the truth.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's back, so he wants to go out on a high note with Bond, which apparently the last one wasn't, which, let's face it, is correct. Mm-hmm. So let's
The last
hope.
One was more of a kind of...
Yeah, it was the last one was pitchy.
Like that.
That's amazing. You should be on The X Factor.
I should be on
The X Factor. As one of the pitchy people that gets kicked off in the first week.
I'd like to do a Skyfall by Adele. Yeah. Skyfall! Crumble!
It's amazing. Yeah. I'd like to apologise to all the listeners who are left.
In fairness. So what do we feel about this? Do we feel, I mean, Eon seem to have some sort of... They seem to feel that Daniel Craig is Bond and they don't want to... bring anyone else in. They don't want to indoctrinate anyone else into the role at this point in time. Is there such a connection? Do audiences have that connection with Daniel Craig as James Bond? Or would this have been the right time
To bring in Jodie Whittaker
and really strike out for Pastures New?
I think they're probably right that people wanted one more Daniel Craig, because last one wasn't a high note. I think if he'd left after Skyfall, I think people probably would have been happier in a way. Uh-huh. But leaving after Spectre, everyone's a bit like, you know, yeah. You know, right now he's done 2 out of 3 good Bond films and 1 not so good. Maybe he's hoping to make it 75% good.
Hang on. Are we doing podcast maths or real maths here?
Real maths.
Okay, so he's done 4 Bond films.
Wait, no, I'm wrong. Yes, he's done 4 Bond films, 2 good, 2 bad.
Okay, so you're... Yeah,
I was forgetting
you
one.
You made the mistake of... You just forgot about Quantum of Solace, which is fair.
No, I actually forgot about Spectre. Well done, me.
Okay. the most recent one.
That's good. So right now he's 50-50.
Right about now he's 50-50.
Yeah.
Just like
and he
Lamar
wants to go 60-40. Yeah.
He wants to go... Hang on. Yes!
Thank
that
you.
Works.
Thank
that
you.
Works! That works, yes.
Got there in the end.
I think that's true. And I obviously, at some point, Eon have driven a Brinks truck filled with gold and they've backed it up and they've given him a season ticket at Anfield and all the sorts of stuff that would appeal to him. But I think at a certain level, I think it is about that. He does genuinely want to go out in the high, and I think he probably recognises the Spectre was not that. And so, therefore...
So let's hope this one's good and not sucky.
There we go. Jimbo, how do you feel?
About Bond?
They're just general.
Staggeringly indifferent. No. I expect it was terrible, but...
Was it terrible?
It was quite terrible.
Yeah.
A good first hour.
Skyfall was loads
it?
Of fun, and I saw bits of Casino Royale again the other day, and it's really, really good. Really good.
It is
enjoyed
good,
that a lot.
Yeah.
So, in fact, it's funny. I was just thinking about it as I tied someone to a chair and then cut the bottom out and got a knotted rope and started... Anyway, what I do in my spare time is not your business. But I like a good Bond film, unlike Helen. And and I'm interested to see him do another one. I mean, I don't really hold with all of the excitement over the... Oh, who's going to be Bond? Is it going to be Idris Elba? I mean, ultimately, I don't really care. You know, it doesn't matter. Like, when Daniel Craig got cast as Bond, everyone was like, who the fuck is Daniel Craig? You know, it was like, what, Leia Kate? Hmm? You know, wasn't he in Tomb Raider? What's going on? Do you know what I mean? It doesn't matter. Kind of, he grew into the role, and it was less about him and more about, you know, the complete change in tone and the fact that Casino Royale was very well written.
I think that if there was less insanity over the whole Bond thing, as you've kind of touched on, I would like it a lot more. Yeah. The fact that even, you know, it's freaking tabloid cover news in this country. It just drives me up the wall. Mm. So anyway. There was good news this week, though.
I was in Malta, and I walked past a news agent in Malta, and it was on the front page in Malta that Daniel Craig had been cast in that role.
Madness.
But it's like, you know, oh, could we have a black Bond? I mean, it's like, who cares? You know, we just cast someone good. None of this stuff matters. You know, it's all so politicised about this sort of stuff. Oh, no, I almost want... That said, there's a part of me... The Schadenfreude in me would like to see a female Bond cast, if just to see the expressions on all those misogynist twats' faces as they get apoplectic on the internet over it. So I think that would be quite fun.
It would be nice.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about good news.
Is good news. That was good
that
news.
That was news.
Very good news
it
for
was
Daniel
barely
Craig's
news.
Accountant.
I mean, it was barely news,
it was
wasn't
news.
It? Anyway, Michael Sheen and David Tennant have signed up to star in Good Omens.
Coming straight to video near you.
It's TV.
It's a Sky One drama, isn't it?
No, it's not. I mean, literally everything you've just said has been wrong.
Okay, you can tell I haven't read the story. Where is it coming to, Helen? Please tell us.
It's coming to the BBC and Amazon. So I think it'll be the BBC in this country, Amazon worldwide.
Obviously I said Sky because the ones they've done, was it Hogfather and
okay, but those were just Terry Pratchett Discworld stories, and this one is different. This
always felt to me like a kind of a Discworld, mainly because death's in it, you know.
Right, but it's totally not a Discworld. Yeah. It's actually
it's set on Earth,
a spin on The Omen. And it has two of the main characters. It's quite a large ensemble. But two of the main characters are an angel and a devil, or a demon. And their names are Aziraphale and Crowley. And they have been cast as, respectively, Michael Sheen and David Tennant. Although, actually, Martin Sheen would be great too. Darn, I kind of want to see that.
Isn't there a supernatural connection here?
A supernatural connection to Good Omens.
Why has a supernatural bell got off in my head when you said Crowley, devil?
There is, there is a demon in... The King of Hell in Supernatural is called Crowley, yeah.
And it all becomes clear.
They are very open about the fact that they rip off Neil Gaiman all the time. My lawyers suggest. That's a whole different thing. But this is a kind of a spin on The Omen. Mm. So this is, what if instead of the Antichrist being handed to the ambassador and his wife, there was a mix-up at the hospital and he was raised instead by very quiet middle-class Brits as a perfectly normal kid. And that's sort of the setup for the whole thing. So, you know, the Antichrist has been born, heaven and hell are planning this big war, but the Antichrist isn't where he's supposed to be, and nobody knows where he is. And that's sort of the setup of the story. It's really, really good. There was a BBC radio drama a couple of Christmases ago, which was, I thought, just okay, and I think they needed to do more adaptation and be a bit looser with the book in order to make it work. But given it comes from Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, who are two of my favourite writers, I'm still super on board with it. And as long as obviously Neil Gaiman is adapting it at Terry's request. It was one of his final requests to Neil Gaiman. So you've got to hope that this one gets it super, super right, because it could be great.
Mm. And what do you think of the casting? Happy with the casting?
Super happy. As soon as I heard those two names, I'm like, well, obviously I know who they're playing. Like, it's a very, very big cast, but immediately, like, well, they're obviously Aziraphale and Crowley. That just makes sense. So, yeah, 100%. I would say David Tennant is the more nailed on of the two terms of my mental image of the character, but Michael Sheen is not far off. He's going to be really good at it.
Absolutely. I need to go back and reread that book. I remember loving that book.
It's brilliant.
Years and years ago, so I need to give it another go.
I think mine is actually signed by Terry Pratchett, if I recall correctly.
Mine's signed by both.
Mine's lost. So, there we go.
Good times.
There was another bit of news this week about Hellboy. American Honey's star, Sasha Lane, has been cast as the love interest, basically, in the rebooted Hellboy. She was phenomenal in that film. Absolutely unbelievable. And she's a really, really interesting actor. I don't know what she's going to do with this, because that was such a different kind of a film. It was sort of semi-improvised and kind of really loose and loosey-goosey. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what she brings to kind of a big studio movie. But she's going to be playing Alice Monaghan in this story, who was kidnapped by fairies and rescued by Hellboy.
Same.
Yeah, I know. But she reappears as a baby, and then she reappears later as a grown woman, and then there's a bit of a love story.
Ooh,
it's a bit weird, isn't it? A bit of a age difference there, as there would be between her and her lead, who would of course be David Harbour.
David Harbour.
So yeah, I think that's good. I'm really, really glad she's getting such a high profile job, and I hope she gets more of them, because yeah, I think she's brilliant.
She's also signed on to star in Ben Wheatley's Freak Shift.
Well, there you go.
So two of her films after American Honey are both kind of weird genre pieces.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything to read into that. I just wanted to say it and point it out.
Okay.
There you go. So Sasha Lane in Hellboy. What's it called again? Hellboy the Blood Queen, or Hellboy? It's called something, isn't it? It's called Hellboy something.
Yeah.
Hellboy something.
Bloody Hellboy.
Bloody Hellboy. There you go. You come to the Emperor podcast for definitive takes on movie news. We know all the names of the upcoming movies.
Well, we know bits of them.
We know bits and pieces. Mm. So Hellboy is coming to cinemas very,
Hellboy?
Very soon.
Did you see they're remaking License to Drive?
I did see that. Mm. And like you with Bond, I'm staggeringly indifferent.
You're not a fan?
No.
Is License to Drive, wait, what?
1988 film, The Corries.
With The Corries.
And Heather Graham, interestingly.
I mean, I remember being super hyped for that when I saw it on a video store shelf when I was like 11, but I haven't been super hyped about it ever since.
I haven't watched it in many decades. The only scene from that film I remember is one where, and I think Hame is driving, and I think it's Feldman in the back, and I want to say, like, Heather Graham's unconscious and Feldman is using his camera to take pictures up her skirt.
What?
Which is really, really, really creepy. But that's, weirdly, the only scene I remember. But this is going to be a female-centric remake. No casting, I believe, announcements have been made as yet. But so that's a thing that we can all be
interested
in.
So wait, are there...
Women drivers? I mean, that's not going to work, is it? I mean, I'm going to be crashing into walls and stuff and, like, parking in double yellow lines because,
Do we have enough female actresses named Corey for this even to work? I mean...
It's a valid point.
Kobe is kind of like Corey.
Yeah, I've got a friend called Corey. There's probably some Corys out there.
Kobe Smulders and Corey...
Okay, yeah. This is super going to work.
It's not going to work.
Corey Maguire, my friend.
Corey Maguire. Okay,
yeah,
there you go. Kobe and Corey together at last.
Speaking of female twists on existing stories, St. Vincent is set to direct a version of The Picture of Dorian Gray, which is, of course, the Oscar Wilde story about the very, very beautiful dude who gets his picture painted and then the picture ages and shows all of his moral degeneration while he himself remains super hot. And it's going to be
one of those pictures, as you know.
A lady twist. Really?
Yeah, as you know.
Is the pristine version?
The really hot pictures in the attic.
Okay.
And yeah. You're the moral degeneracy.
I'm the moral, yeah.
Was
that not clear?
That makes a lot more sense, yeah. So anyway, this is coming from St. Vincent, who's she, I think, did have a debut film recently. She was part of the XX horror anthology.
Yes. St. Vincent, for people who don't know who that is a musician-y lady, isn't she?
She is a musician-y lady, and that's about as far as my musical knowledge goes.
She does the singing. I've heard a couple of her songs, and I was tapping my foot to them a little bit. I had a bit of a groovy beat. Probably not.
Yeah, and the screenplay is by David Burke, who wrote Elle, in the French film recently.
Okay.
So that's a really good sign. It's not that long since the last Dorian Gray movie.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
I will.
Ben Barnes?
Correct.
Ben Barnes. What's happened to him? Where's he been? What's he up to? Ben, if you're listening, write in. We're worried about you. Call your mother. Honestly.
Yeah.
Staying out so late.
That was 2009, though.
2009!
Longer than it seems.
That was Colin Firth, Ben Barnes, and who was the lady in that?
There was a lady in it.
Corey
sure.
McGuire.
Carey Mulligan.
Was it?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Right. Anyway, we're really bringing you the definitive film knowledge today.
Dorian Gray was in Penny Dreadful.
He was in Penny Dreadful. Yeah. Played by?
I don't remember.
That's right. And and he was, of course, in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Played
yes.
by?
Stuart Townsend.
Yes. I really liked him in that. I thought that was
Franchise
a really clever...
Bridesmaid Stuart Townsend.
I thought that was a really clever twist on the character, though.
He didn't hold a candle to his vampire Lestat in Queen of the Damned.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what could?
Well, quite.
His Aragorn, perhaps, in Lord of the Rings.
In Lord of the Rings.
Oh, well, never mind.
Ah, well. Do you think there's a world where he's really famous and Eric Stoltz is really, really famous and Michael J. Fox and Viggo Mortensen are just like sweeping the floors at the back of Asda?
And Pauly Shore was like in all of Tom Hanks' roles.
Well, what did Pauly Shore do?
Reeve Carney in Penny Dreadful.
Who played Spider-Man in Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark on Broadway.
There we go.
Which I'm hoping to get tickets for when I go over in December. I hear it's quite the hot stuff. So,
how does one turn off dark?
Turning on a light.
By doing a show that loses millions of dollars, I think. So they have to eventually flick the switch in that one.
So Hannibal might be coming back. That's
Hooray!
Quite exciting.
Yeah, it is very exciting. I've just been watching some.
The Brian Fuller Hannibal.
Yeah.
Yeah,
which got cancelled in 2015. He said at the time, when there was a big fan uprising about bringing it back, that they might look at it in 2 years when the rights to Silence of the Lambs expired. And true to his word, he has said that that is possibly moving ahead. So that's exciting. Won't go to NBC, I wouldn't think, given that they killed it last time, but I'm sure he's shopping it around.
Yeah.
But that would be nice.
Netflix.
Well, quite, yes. It will undoubtedly land somewhere a bit like that.
Amazon Prime room.
He is working with Amazon Prime, of course, for American Gods, so.
So possibly.
Could work. But that would be super exciting because it's the most stylish, murdery show ever made, I think. It's fair to say.
It is. It's very... I can never understand whether it makes me hungry or sick because like they're so fetishistic with the food and yet also with the vivisection. It's quite...
Did I tell you about the time, I think Nick and I went to, I think it was season two, it might have been season three. What's the season where he starts off, he's in Europe? Hannibal's
that's,
in Europe.
That's the, is it three?
Three.
It's the last one.
Okay,
yeah.
Season three. So we went to the very first... we went to a special screening of the first episode of season three. And it was a really bespoke little cinema-type place in London. And they served in between. They stopped at every act break. They stopped at every ad break. And they served us disgusting-looking food that, you know, tasted great, obviously, by a gourmet chef. The idea was that, you know, the idea was like almost to echo every time there was an act of violence on screen, you would have food as well. And it felt really decadent and... I just, you know...
That reminds
really...
me of two things.
Yes.
The first thing is that I went to a screening of Killer Joe and they served fried chicken before the screening. And as it happened, I wasn't that hungry and I didn't have any. And I was super glad when I actually saw the film because if you
context
remember that
film... Context is
everything. The use of fried chicken there was super gross. and secondly, I did something extremely fancy recently. I went to the Fat Duck, which is Hessen Blumenthal's super, super fancy restaurant. And... basically, all the food there is like performance art. Yeah. And I feel like Hannibal would have been completely at home, except he would have wanted more, you know, long pig than we had.
Would you recommend the Fat Duck? Because I hear that he...
If you've been saving up,
about it.
If you've been saving up for the past, like, ever, then I would definitely recommend it.
How much is it roughly? Give people an idea.
I can't get the words out.
Where's the decimal point?
I mean, the decimal point is after three places.
It's after three places?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. The Fat Duck.
Bear in mind, I'm teetotal.
Yes, you are. Yeah. You are. So there you go. Lots of bottled water, please. Lots of tap water. Tap water. Tap water, please. I have to see you pour that in the tap. So Fat Duck. We should also talk about Tom Cruise. We should talk about Tom Cruise because...
Lovely man.
This week came the news that he has broken his ankle. The indestructible, indefatigable Tom Cruise has broken his ankle while doing a stunt on the set of Mission Impossible 6.
Yeah.
And the footage was captured by a rogue amateur photographer who put it onto the internet, obviously. The moment where you can see Tom Cruise actually break his ankle and he's swinging between two buildings. He slams into the building and then he hauls himself up into the building, the top of the roof of the building, which is Baynard House in East London, I believe. And he staggers off camera and then sinks to his knees and you go, oh, this is bad. So there's lots of speculation this week, lots of rumours that he had broken his leg in multiple places and that Mission Impossible 6 would have to be shut down for months and that it would miss its release date of July 27th? Next
sure.
year? Sure, why not? Sure, let's say that. Lots of rumours and are rife at the moment. But Chris McQuarrie, who has been mainstay of this podcast, of course, he called us last night, in fact, and set the record straight. And yes, Mission Impossible 6 is going on hiatus for a couple of months because Tom Cruise has broken his right ankle and will need a while to get back on his feet, quite literally on his feet, but the production will be now moving into the editorial phase, and then when he comes back, they'll shoot some stuff as well. But he says, Chris McQuarrie says, they will not be missing their date. But
and as the director, he would know.
As the director, he would know. But of course, it's very interesting. He also says the stunt was not a stunt gone wrong; it was a stunt gone too right. If anything that had happened, they did four rehearsals. He was meant to slam into the building each time. Ethan Hunt's meant to miss the building and just by grab on for his life. And on the fourth take, he broke his ankle. And there you go.
And soldiered on with the take.
Soldiered on with the take.
Of course he did.
55 years old, Tom Cruise is. And Chris McQuarrie said, I asked a question. I said, is this Tom Cruise's body sent him a signal? You know, that it's time to stop jumping off buildings. It's time to stop doing this stuff. He says, no, he's in better... And he is in better shape at 55 than I am at whatever age I am. But it's not 55. Ha ha, Wing Cruise. But I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, I'm pleased that he's on the mend, and I'm pleased at Macquarie's optimism. Mm-hmm. And I think he's probably right that it may prove to be a blessing in disguise, because if he's able to start editing the film together now, getting some of the post-production work done at this earlier stage, you know, it gives you time to reflect, mm-hmm. to think, to make sure you've got everything as sharp and as clever and as brilliant as it can be. It could end up being the best thing that's ever happened to a film, you know. So fingers crossed for them, and obviously get well soon, Tom Cruise.
Absolutely.
Didn't do The Force Awakens any harm.
That's true.
Indeed. Yeah, very much the same thing happened on The Force Awakens, where Harrison Ford broke his leg in an on-set snafu, and they took time to recalibrate as well. So, indeed. And we should finish out the news section by talking about the tragic death that occurred on the set of Deadpool 2 last week, where a stunt motorcycle rider, Joy Harris, SJ Joy Harris, perished in a stunt on the set of the movie. And I don't think we're qualified in any way, shape or form to talk about exactly what happened, but someone has lost a life on the set of a movie, and it's very, very, very sad indeed.
Yeah, the work that stunt people do is just so impressive throughout, you know, history. The kind of stuff that they do seems impossible, and they make us believe in it, and they make us believe in movies, and they're enormously important to productions. And yet they take these great risks upon themselves. Our hearts go out to her family and friends and the whole production, who must be shaken by this. And let's hope that... let's hope that, you know, there's no further accidents, because two in a week, I think, is quite enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we know of.
Indeed. So our hearts indeed go out to the family of Joy Harris, who died on the set of Deadpool 2 last week. Okay, so we should have a guest now, don't you think, Hill?
Yes.
We should. Yes, indeed, we should have an Empire guest, and he is an Empire legend, and I mean that literally, because we gave him a trophy sentence. Pretty much the same at the 2016 Jemison Empire Awards. He elevates every movie he's in, whether it's an Oscar-worthy drama or blockbuster schlock. He is possibly the only person to escape Transformers the last night with his reputation intact, maybe even enhanced, because he had the good sense to get out while the going was good. And now he's back in the director's chair this week with Final Portrait, which tackles an interesting episode in the life of the acclaimed painter and sculptor Alberto Giacometti. He is, of course, the great Stanley Tucci, Latouche himself. And he was speaking to R. Phil, who took time out from negotiating a move to a more lucrative Spanish podcast in this very room earlier this week. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined by Stanley Tucci on the Empire podcast for a second visit. I don't know if you remember this, Stanley, but your last visit was with Elizabeth Banks to talk about the Hunger Games.
Oh my gosh.
It got sweary. Did it? Really, really fucking fast. And we're quite a sweary podcast. Our swear jar is a bucket, but you took it on a level.
Well,
so thank
what
you.
Can I say? Yeah.
I mean, you know, and actually that's sort of where I wanted to start, because we're here to talk about your new directorial film, Final Portrait, which is a film about Alberto Giacometti.
Yeah.
You expect, you know, it's a film about high art, obviously, and the creative process, but it's also a film about some very creative swearing. And you've got Jeffrey Rush. His sort of line reading of the word fuck. Can you just talk me through how that came about?
Well, first of all, it's done with a Swiss-Italian accent, which is a strange accent. And it's used very often. And he also swears in French as well, and Italian.
Yeah.
We had a lot. There's a lot in there. There's a lot that's not in there that we shot. Yeah. But it started to become too much.
It's kind of a fuck is sort of two syllables, isn't it? It's a fuck.
It's a fuck. Yes.
It's a lovely film, and Jeffrey Rush is so good in this role of this artist. I mean, everyone kind of knows about Giacometti because his work has famously gone for blockbuster amounts of money.
Yeah, the largest ever paid for a contemporary sculpture.
Which was about
like 140 million or 20 million, something like that.
And where do you hang it?
I don't know what you do with it.
You did. It wasn't your purchase.
It certainly wasn't mine. Yeah.
But I guess you know, with these great artists, people often don't know that much about them and about what went into the art.
Yeah, no, they don't. I mean, a lot of times we see the result of that. We see obviously the art itself, but and then you see with the price that is paid for it. But people don't know that, you know, up until the late 40s, nobody was buying Giacometti's work,
right?
You know, The Tate actually bought a work very early, earlier than most museums. In the late 40s that they bought. But he was an incredible artist. You know, he worked diligently and very strangely in through the night. And then he would sleep until like 2 in the afternoon. Then he'd get up and smoke more cigarettes and, you know, drink coffee. And then he'd work again. And then he'd go out to dinner. And then he'd work through the night again. He had the most unhealthy lifestyle ever, but created some of the greatest work ever.
He looks like a man who's sort of on the verge of death.
Yeah,
moments in the film.
He always looked like he was like, you know, 80, even though he was only 65 when he died. Yeah,
you kind of want him to just get on with it. I mean, the setup of the film is this true life portrait that he painted of an American writer.
James Lord.
James Lord, who's played by Armie Hammer, who sits for him. He's expecting it to be maybe a day or two.
Yeah, he says, you know, I'll paint your portrait and do it in an afternoon, a day or two at the most. And it ends up being 18 days, and it became this book called The Giacometti Portrait, on which I based the film. And it's their conversations during those 18 days, some of which were really funny, some of which are incredibly insightful. It's probably the best book written about the creative process, but also is really a frustrating experience because Lord had to keep changing his flight and had to sit for hours and hours and hours on end and watch Giacometti just, you know, sort of go through many phases of self-loathing, you know. So
Did you find, I mean, Armie's talked about how the acting process in this film is sort of analogous with what's actually happening in the story. You know, he has to sit there for the whole film.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself sort of having a kind of a teacher-student dynamic with him, just telling, you know, sit still, Armie?
No, he was really good. He's very diligent, Armie. No, he was great. He was really great. But it is hard. It's frustrating because, I mean, the story of making this is the story of the film itself in a way.
Yeah.
You know, one guy sitting there getting frustrated about, oh, how can I really make this look like I'm painting? Or how can I really, you know, I want to get this right. And then Armie going, you know, I don't know if I can sit here for much longer.
Yeah. Do you ever have that experience in your acting career where you're on a movie and you call back for reshoots and you're having to swap your life around and you're just like, I'm not comparing necessarily the...
Oh, no, all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think, I thought it was over. I thought we were done, you know? And they say, no, they need you for one more day. And you're like, do they really?
Yeah.
Do they really need me? And then you go and do it, and you're glad you did it because the movie's better for it.
Okay. That seems like
not because of me, but I'm just saying because of the scene.
You walk away before you finish, and you're like, "I've just one more day of me," and this film would just tip into awards contention.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No question. You've known Jeffrey, I mean, I don't know if you knew him before The Life and Death of Peter Sellers.
I didn't.
There's a really interesting, I was looking back at that film. It was a film here, I think it was a miniseries in the US. And you play Stanley Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
And he plays at one point you playing Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you there for that? That was very strange.
I don't think I was there for that. No.
No.
It was a long time ago now. No, but I really liked Jeffrey. He was really nice and funny, obviously, and talented. Yeah. He did a brilliant job in that.
Yeah.
So he was always kind of in my mind for this role.
You were on, just final on the Peter Sellers, you as Kubrick, you were on the set of The War Room from Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah.
Was that weird?
It was so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing what they did. Yeah. I mean, it's one of my favorite movies. Yeah. I just showed it to my son, actually. Ooh. My 17-year-old.
Did you?
Yeah.
I would imagine right now might be a time that you'd want to not watch that film, potentially.
Yeah, but... well, we watched it before Trump came into office, okay. So yeah.
What's next? Failsafe.
Jesus, you're right. I know. God.
Jeffrey smokes a lot of cigarettes as Giacometti. Mm. You know, we talked about his self-destructive streak, his sort of flamboyantly self-destructive streak. You had a similar experience, I believe, on Road to Perdition. Mm-hmm. You played Frank Nitti, the Italian-American gangster.
Mm.
And I gather that you smoked up to 80 cigarettes.
Oh, I don't know how many.
IMDb is very... meticulous on the numbers.
I can't really imagine that's true.
No.
But no, there can't be that many.
It wasn't that many.
And also, you're not ever smoking an entire cigarette. So, but anyway, you're smoking a lot.
Yeah.
And I guess we weren't using the herbal cigarettes. I guess we were just using regular cigarettes. And I felt so sick.
Really?
It's happened like 3 times on movies to me.
When you're not are you a smoker? Were you a smoker?
Yeah, I was smoking. Yeah. I used to, occasionally, you take a cigarette, but not... like that, you know. That's like, ugh.
Really?
Yeah, it's bad.
So Sam would go again, and you sort of book in with your sort of GP.
So you're very careful in how you have to.
I see.
Yeah,
fair enough. So Jeffrey was okay because you are using herbal.
He was fine. He's a very healthy smoker. Yeah,
fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. I noticed on the thank yous at the end of the credits, Steve Buscemi's name.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a story behind that?
Well, Steve is a very good friend of mine, and we have a production company together called Olive Productions. Uh-huh. So that's why. Because Steve's always been very helpful to me in when we're working on a project, you know, one of our own projects, we'll usually send it to the other to read first or to, you know, look at it, ask advice and stuff like that.
Right.
He's one of my dearest friends.
Did he give you some good notes on this one?
Yeah, well, God, he read it so many years ago. He still hasn't seen the film.
Oh, really?
But no, but he read it many, many years ago.
So he doesn't know he's thanked.
No, he doesn't know he's thanked.
You've had, away from directing, you've had an interesting, unusual year as an actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, you played a singing piano.
Yes.
Which is something I'm sure you were waiting for, that opportunity.
Yeah. For decades. Yeah.
And also, and I have to ask you about this, Transformers. You played two characters in the Transformers franchise,
mm-hmm.
which is a bit of a mind meld
in
itself. But in the most recent Transformers, you play a drunk wizard, Merlin.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just tell us what that experience was like? A lot of people were like, Stanley Tucci appears as a drunk wizard, and then he doesn't come back, but we were sort of expecting him to come back. Were you expecting to come back?
I wanted to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to come back as either of those characters. I had a great time. You know, the first one was really fun. It was obviously a five-month shoot for me, but it was really fun. I loved working with Michael. We traveled all over the place, and a great character and all that. And then when they were making this one, we thought that they were going to bring all those characters back again. And they basically didn't. They brought Mark back, and then there was a whole new thing. And I thought, well, that's sad. I really wanted to make another one.
Yeah.
And then they said, okay, Michael wants you to play this other role. And I was like, what are you talking about? I don't understand. It doesn't even make sense. They said, no. And then I read it, and I thought, well, this is fantastic. This is really funny. So I went and I worked for a week. We shot here. We shot in Ireland. And I had the best time ever with, you know, all that great makeup and doing accent and all that stuff. It was a gas. So if they make another one, I'd happily come back as Merlin. Yeah.
Do you remember any of your dialogue as drunk Merlin?
No, I was drunk. Of course I don't.
This is not intended to sound in any way glib. I mean, you've been directing for quite a long time now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you picked up from Michael Bay as a director?
Yeah. The thing is, Michael has an incredible visual sense. And what I really like about Michael, and this is what Steve Buscemi said to me, because Steve worked with him a couple times a long time ago, and he said the thing about working, when I was going to work with Michael the first time, he goes, the thing about working with Michael, he says, it's like making an independent movie with a shitload of money. and he's right, because Steve and I, the movies that we direct are independent movies, and he was right, because Michael's incredibly spontaneous, and that's what I really like about him, and that's the way I love to be as an actor and love to be as a director. And that just sort of solidified my belief in that process. He really loves actors, and he's not afraid. Like, you have your script, and you come in, you've got your lines ready to go, and he goes, oh, fuck it. So don't say that. Say something else. I go, what do you want me to say? He goes, I don't know, just make it up. And then we have the best time, and then it becomes playful. The camera keeps running. He's throwing out direction to you, and I go, wait, what about this? What about that? Let me try one like this. Blah, blah, blah. And it's really exciting and visceral. And I really, really like that. A lot of directors are just rather pedantic. They're just kind of, you know, you do the thing, you say the lines, then cut, and you wait while everybody futzes around with something, and then they go, okay, again. And then you do it like 10 times, and you're so bored by the end, you're just trying to invent something.
Did you have that experience on Devil Wears Prada, where there was an opportunity to sort of improvise, extemporize?
Yes, to a certain extent, yes. Not quite as much on like Michael's movies.
but
David is such a wonderful director. He's very judicious in his, like, he'll do a few takes and that's it.
Right.
But he's a really, really very specific director.
Yeah. Can't let you go without asking you about one of our favorite movie dads, Dil.
In Easy A.
Yeah. Right. I mean, what a character. Great. Patricia Clarkson, have incredible chemistry. I've read you say that you parent like Dil.
No, this is completely untrue.
You, but Okay.
No, sorry. I mean, there are times, yeah. Yes, when, yes, I'm quite flippant, you know, and laid back to a certain extent. But for the most part, no. I wish I were that relaxed.
No, you haven't told them they're adopted or anything like that in jest.
Oh, yes, actually, I have said that.
Bastard. And they spell swear words in P's.
Yes,
spell it with your P's. Got to let you go shortly. Just lastly, a couple of things. I wondered if, I mean, the directorial life doesn't work this way, obviously. So if I ask you what your next movie that you want to direct is, I'm sure it's over the horizon. But do you have things that are kind of itching away?
Oh, yeah, without question. Yeah, there are plays that I want to direct. There's a movie that I've written based on a book called City of Women that takes place in Berlin at the end of World War II.
Right.
So I'm hoping to put that together in the next year or so. And then, you know, acting and stuff, whatever I...
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever comes down the pike.
And very lastly, we in the office are big fans of your work.
Thank you.
And we have a nickname for you. I don't know if it's our nickname for you, if it's something that you get elsewhere.
I don't know.
We call you the Tooch.
Oh, yes. No, that's
this is your nickname.
Fine.
Yes, that's absolutely
that's
okay.
That's very common.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Yes.
So we're not.
In fact, my father was called Tooch.
Right.
And that's it. Yeah. And I have a mug of his, like a shaving mug or something.
Yeah.
It said Tooch on it from college.
So you have a mug that says Tooch, but I presume you don't use it for your tea?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, I drink espresso.
A tiny Tooch mug.
Tiny Tooch.
Thank you very much for joining us, Stanley Tucci, the Tooch.
Thank
Appreciate
you so
it.
Much. Thanks.
Stanley Tucci there. We weren't around for that, Helen.
No, alas. Alas and alack.
A big shame. Big shame. I would have asked him about his Levi jeans commercial from the 1980s. Have you seen that?
I have.
You seen that?
It is wonderful. It is a thing of absolute joy.
He's a feral bald man. James, you must love him.
I consider him a personal role model.
Do you remember him in Murder One? He wasn't bald in it, but he was really good. That was his, I think, big breakthrough, really.
So you don't remember him in Murder One?
I've never seen Murder One, to be honest.
Oh, you'd love it. It's brilliant.
No, I never saw
you it. Who has seen every TV show, American TV show, because this weird disdain for British stuff.
Yeah.
Ever
apparently,
made.
Apart from that one.
Really?
Yeah. Never
What's
saw
the
it?
Musical one?
I'm sorry?
There was a cop rock. Do you remember that?
What?
Okay, now you've just made that up.
There's a show, and it was by the. I'm pretty sure it's by the same guy who did NYPD Blue, and it was
Bochco.
Yes, and it was called Cop Rock, and it was a musical cop show.
And it's about a cop that can't be stopped, is it?
Pretty much,
unless he rocks.
And it ran. You won't be surprised to know for just a few episodes, and then got cancelled.
You shock and astound me.
I'm not googling this because if we've been consistent with one thing this week, it's not knowing what the hell we're talking about. So if I'm right about this, if there is a show called Cop Rock, then do write in and let us know.
Okay.
Okay. So as I said earlier, we have teamed up with Sky Atlantic for this week's podcast to celebrate the release of their new thriller, Tin Star. And it's exciting for me, but it's even more exciting for Helen O'Hara because she was on set of Tin Star. Hell's Bells.
Yes. So I got to go to Calgary late last year in the middle of the winter, and I got to tour the sets and the locations and meet the cast. And so I've been looking forward to this show a lot ever since then. So Calgary, for those of you who don't know, is sort of the Texas of Canada. It's the heart of the oil industry there. It's about as close to the Wild West as you can get these days, hence the influences of classic Westerns on this series. We started off in a very posh restaurant in downtown Calgary, where Christina Hendricks was playing Mrs. Bradshaw, who's an oil company PR expert.
Oh, Mrs. Bradshaw.
Oh, can't trust her. And she was busy threatening her dining companion at the time. Ask yourself what I might be prepared to do to ensure your silence was one line I remember.
Oh, thank God.
According to Hendricks, her character started out with good intentions and was kind of like basically an environmentalist, and she wanted to then start to try to change the world from the inside by working for this company. But she does seem to have lost her way. The executive producer, Alison Jackson, told us it's not an environmental thriller, but that is part of the kind of the mix here. But most of the action takes place in the town of High River, which plays Little Big Bear. And that's where Tim Roth's character Jim Worth becomes the sheriff after trading in a career as a London undercover cop for something that he thought would be quieter. We headed out to Avalanche Country, according to a road sign, to his country home. And you can see why they decided that this would be like a perfect place to raise a family. They've got this amazing house dusted with snow on the bend of an icy river that looked like Leonardo DiCaprio might crawl out of the water at any moment wearing a bearskin.
The big puddle sitter.
Exactly. Despite my slightly frozen feet, I volunteered to move in immediately. But sadly, it's turned out that some quite dark stuff was happening in the house and there were some blood trails around the area, and as night fell, some fire crews came in and the gorgeous Desrez began to look a little bit more threatening. That's all a bit like Worth himself. Underneath a friendly, law-abiding exterior, there's a very dark past, another side that he once tapped into to go undercover among the very worst of the worst. And so Roth tells us that you can kind of tweak the characters you go on a 10-episode show and shade him and push him in different directions. And in this case, it sounded like he'd given his character some very dark shade, and I don't mean glasses. So you've got a sheriff with a taste for violence who's out for revenge after he's wronged. There's a big company, its commercial interests on the line. Everything is set on a collision course, and a little bit of damage to property is frankly going to be the least of anybody's concerns. So I'm looking forward to seeing how it turns out, and I'll be able to do so on
September 7th,
when all the episodes will be available on Sky.
Or you can wait, because it's all weekly.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
So many choices.
So huge, huge choices. So Tin Star there, September 7th, Helen was on set. Long flight?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, okay, all right. Tin Star, September 7th, Sky Atlantic. And right, now, time to talk about the reviews portion of the show. We're going to start off with the first in a planned series of films that will bring Stephen King's magnum opus, The Dark Tower, to the big screen. At least, that was the plan. Because I've got a sneaky suspicion, and I will say this, I haven't seen The Dark Tower yet, and I'm a massive Stephen King fan.
Yeah.
I've read everything Stephen King's ever written, including grocery lists, and I haven't seen The Dark Tower. I've missed every screening. And I've got a sneaking suspicion that I may have dodged a bullet, which is difficult to do with Roland Deschain, but there you go. So talk us through this. So this one doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere. And am I missing out? Am I missing anything?
Sadly, no. As much as it pains me to say, this feels like the sort of Cliff Notes version of the Stephen King book, which maybe was inevitable if you're turning eight very lengthy novels into a 90-minute film, but it feels particularly stripped to its bones, I have to say. So, I mean, the story starts, we're told that a dark tower stands at the center of the universe, mm-hmm. holds creation together.
It does.
But it's said it can be toppled by the mind of a child.
What?
And then we're introduced to Matthew McConaughey's Man in Black, uh-huh. and he's trying to use children in a sort of infernal machine to bring the tower down.
You cursed villain.
And then we learn that this has all been part of a vision or a nightmare for young Jake Chambers, who's played by Tom Taylor. Uh-huh. And he's seeing all these visions of what's going on, but obviously can't kind of control them, doesn't know what's real, what isn't. Is being sent for a sort of psychiatric evaluation, all this kind of stuff, because his parent, or his mother and his sort of her boyfriend are worried about him. And then he finds a portal to another world and realizes it is all true when he goes through and he meets the gunslinger Roland, who's played by Idris Elba.
Have you read all the books?
No.
Because I haven't, and yet saw this, and it felt to me at once that it tried to cover far too much in too short a time, but at other points it felt like it was doing the opposite. Do you know what I mean? It was a slightly odd thing. It made me desperate to see the sort of, you know, four-season HBO miniseries on the same subject, quite frankly. That would have been amazing.
That could have worked. This, I agree. It feels completely stripped down and sort of accelerated in order to kind of fit it in. There's bits that are clearly meant to be significant, and yet their significance is lost. And I think when you have something that involves, I mean, I said this in the review, but, you know, you've got lines like, his shine is pure, and the whole notion about the Dark Tower, you've got all these kind of throwaway lines that don't make a lot of sense in themselves. Mm. And so you need to have that context to make them feel sensible instead of nonsensical. Mm. And we didn't really have that. I mean, I thought Idris Elba actually was great. I thought he was super cool. I really liked all of his reloads. Those were awesome.
Yes.
But the fight scenes themselves were not that good.
No. I think it's a lot of it felt just quite inelegantly directed as well, and the storytelling was very clunky, and they rely too much on really kind of first base 80s fish out of water New York kind of beats, which I just, I mean, the bit about the hot dog, you know, it's like, there are no dogs in this, or whatever the line was. It just, it felt very, very rudimentary.
Yeah.
I think there's a really interesting story in there somewhere, and there were tantalising moments where you'd see glimpses sort of through a pane of glass into the broader sort of Kingverse.
Yes.
Like whether it be sort of Pennywise's name appearing here or a poster appearing there, and you think the mythology of this feels very deep and very intricate, and I feel that we haven't scratched the surface.
Yeah, not even remotely. It felt like a sort of 80s kids film, and not in a particularly good way. I think that's sad but true. I mean, I think Matthew McConaughey as well, it was weird. It was just weird. I mean, his hair was super weird, the sort of kind of dark, spiky thing he had going on. And it sounded like, presumably for effect, they had re-recorded all of his dialogue to give him a weird echo. And it's another distancing, bizarre decision that doesn't really chime.
So this is directed by the Danish director Nikolai Arcel.
Yep.
He's a massive Stephen King fan. Because I wrote the feature for this for Empire, but I still haven't seen the film. He told me that he used the books of Stephen King as he was growing up to help him learn English. Mm-hmm. He's one of Stephen King's constant readers, as am I. As are you. Jimbo, you must be as well, to some extent.
No, I think I've only read The Green Mile.
What?
Really? I'm pretty certain that's the only King
I don't
thing
think
I've
that's
read.
Even top 10.
Mm.
And I haven't finished The Dark Tower.
No, I don't think I've read any of the others.
But I have to say, there's a name in this movie, and he's been connected with this movie all the way through. It's actually not that long gestation period, because Stephen King only really finished the books in 2004 in a flurry of creativity after his car crash, after his car accident. No, he didn't. He wasn't in a car that crashed. He was, anyway. And that's Akiva Goldsman. And Akiva Goldsman was the lead writer in this project, and his name in a project just fills me with dread, and rightly so, from what I understand. Yes?
Yeah, sadly so. I mean, I think there's some not great decision making behind this. I don't actually think it's the fault of any of the cast particularly. I thought Tom Taylor was fine. I thought his American accent didn't slip. He looked shocked when he should and worried when he should, and all, you know, all the stuff that you
expect. He looked at all the right things.
But, you know, all the stuff that you demand of a teen hero in this kind of movie, that's all he had to do, because he didn't get anything. He was basically the plucky kid. There's no extra character there.
That's interesting, because obviously, how much of The Dark Tower have you read?
I mean, I've read enough to have come across Jake.
Yeah. There's an interesting relationship between Jake and Roland, and Roland's a really fascinating character, and every decision I saw in being made in this movie just seemed wrong to me. There's something I quite like the audacious idea that this is actually a sequel to the books, and so there are things, so not everything would go quite the way you expect, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm hoping to see it this weekend, and I'm hopeful that it won't be as bad as I have now been led to believe it is.
Terry, who couldn't be with us on this podcast, asked me to pass on her feelings about the film. And she says, I quote, please tell them it's a load of old shit.
Okay. So. Yeah, that's roughly paraphrased. And I think there were two or three more F-bombs in there as well.
Yeah, she said
it was one of the three worst films she's seen this year.
Which is very harsh. It's very harsh. Like, it's not a good film by any stretch. And I think 2 stars is absolutely nailed on what this is, but
right.
I didn't hate it. It's relatively painless at 90 minutes, and there are it's one of these things. It's like there's something really interesting, but you're staring at it through a very muddy pond. Do you know what I mean? Like there's something deep buried within it which could have been good, and you can recognise the gems of intrigue. They just don't do anything with them, or they just throw them away. So it's not hateful. It's just a catastrophic missed opportunity.
King novels are all about taking fantasy archetypes and Western archetypes and reimagine them, and because the books are long and because you get to know the characters, that he can reframe those archetypes in a really interesting way. And I worry that having a 90-minute film where Roland Deschaine, the gunslinger, is nothing more than just a two-dimensional gunslinger, no matter how good Idris Elba is.
Yeah.
And Matthew McConaughey is a one-dimensional bad guy who likes to go around being bad.
Super
bad. I worry
bad.
That this may seem derivative. It's a little bit like, you know, John Carter coming after Avatar seems derivative of Avatar, even though it's not the case. And I just worry that, you know, you won't get all the nuance that is in the books.
There is little to no nuance.
Which is a real shame. But, you know, My understanding is that there is a really good Stephen King adaptation coming in a few weeks' time.
So, yeah, fingers crossed.
So fingers crossed for that.
I would also like to say that this film, without saying any spoilers, ends on a shot which I'm almost certain is taken directly from Doctor Who.
James doesn't like Doctor Who, you should be aware of that.
But the big plans for this, so it was film, TV show, and then film. I think that's not going to happen,
that
right?
That may not happen, no.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of, I have to say, in terms of book quality to film quality, it's not quite The Dark is Rising, but it's not far off.
So there we go, 2 stars for The Dark Tower. And Jimbo, last week you interviewed Al Gore. You asked about The West Wing, but you also asked him about his new movie, which is an inconvenient sequel, which is a sequel to...
An Inconvenient Truth.
There we go, okay. So tell us about this. This is a documentary.
Yes, An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Everyone probably remembers An Inconvenient Truth. It did indeed win an Oscar. This was in 2006 it was released. And essentially it was a harbinger of the doom of mankind as we spiral towards destruction thanks to global warming.
But it wasn't doomy. It was quite, you know, it was quite optimistic.
I'm not sure that it was optimistic. I thought it more as cautionary. It was like, we are all fucked unless you pay attention. That seemed to be the message of that documentary. It was very much like, you know, don't mess around, pay attention. There's time to fix this, but we need to get moving. And I, perhaps due to my natural sunny outlook, assumed that this would be very much, you know, it would start like the beginning of Mad Max Fury Road with, you know, Al Gore standing next to a car looking out over the wasteland that is the Earth. But it isn't. It's actually a surprisingly upbeat film. It sort of shows the strides that many nations have taken to kind of combat global warming and, you know, and how we've significantly improved renewable energy, the leaps and strides that that's come along in. I mean, yes, there are downsides to it. He shows the consequences that we're already experiencing in terms of weather patterns, in terms of sort of glacier shrinkage and flooding and the sea level in Florida, which has now risen above the main street in Miami. But it's not a doom and gloom film at all. It's not as focused, I don't think, as An Inconvenient Truth, which is very much, I mean, it has a very clear core message. Mm-hmm. This is a bit of a sort of a whistle-stop tour as sort of Gore goes around various places and he sees... the effects of global warming, and then it kind of, you know, its sort of third act climax, if you will, is the signing of the Paris Agreement and kind of his part in making India, in this particular case, you know, helping facilitate them saying yes to what the other countries were proposing. So it's like I say, it's an optimistic film. It ends on a slightly bum note. I don't think that's a spoiler to say that, obviously, you know, if we're talking about the Paris Agreement and, you know, the Trump shadow looms large in the latter part of this film. And there's footage of him obviously saying that, you know, the climate change is a hoax and just basically being an idiot and unhelpful, as he tends to be. And I think that's perhaps the only down point to this. But it's a note of caution in an otherwise film where people are taking steps to combat this. And I think that's a good thing. So it's a kind of don't rest on your laurels, you know, keep doing these things. But it's, you know.
Does it work as a...
It's good.
It works as a documentary. Does it work as a piece of entertainment? Will people want to see this, or will they feel they're being lectured for 2 hours, 90 minutes, whatever it is?
A lot of it depends on how you felt about the first one. It's not as tight as the first one. It is entertaining. It's a broader canvas, and it covers a lot of sort of different areas. I think more than anything else, it's informative. It tells you a lot that I think a lot of people don't know. Like, I think there is a commonly held misconception that renewable energy is less efficient than traditional fossil fueled energy, and that it could not possibly, you know, carry the burden if we switched entirely over to solar and wind. But Gore, of course, demonstrates that this is in fact untrue, vastly untrue. So a lot of it is, I think, people owe it to themselves to see it just to kind of have a better understanding of this very important issue that affects all of us. And also, it is a good film. It's very entertaining. He's an incredibly engaging public speaker. He's very charismatic, and he does make quite a dry subject, that's not a pun, you know, quite entertaining. So yes, recommended. We gave this one 3 stars.
So, do you think it'll be a threequel, or will we all be dead by that point?
It's entirely possible Mad Max is the threequel. Yes, I don't know. We'll see. It depends very much on what happens over the next few years, I would say.
Indeed, 3 stars. 3 stars in for An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. And we haven't, none of us, the three idiots in this booth, haven't seen Stanley Tucci's The Tucci's Final Portrait, but we gave it 4 stars. and said it's very, very good. So, and the Tooch has a sure hand, and the performances from Armie Hammer and Jeffrey Rush are excellent. And it's a look at an artist's life in an interesting way. It's a brief snapshot of a time when Giacometti was trying to struggling with this portrait. So keep your eyes peeled for that one. The Tooch has done it again. 4 stars for Final Portrait. And I will tell you to avoid this week The Hitman's Bodyguard, which is the Sam Jackson, Ryan Reynolds comedy thriller that doesn't really deliver on either of those fronts, sadly. It's a bit of a shame. It really wants to be. It's one of the latest movies that, for me, is trying desperately to be another Midnight Run. Some of the beats from Midnight Run are repeated in this film, beat for beat, and it doesn't quite work. And you have Sam Jackson is this abrasive hitman going toe-to-toe with Ryan Reynolds, who is this fastidious bodyguard, and it's almost spy versus spy, turns into a buddy movie. It doesn't really work. Some nice little flourishes from director Patrick Hughes, but otherwise I fully agree with Empire's 2-star rating of The Hitman's Bodyguard, which is a shame because there are good people involved. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you once again by Sky Atlantic and their new upcoming original revenge thriller starring Tim Roth and Christina Hendricks, 10-star. 10-star, coming to you for binging September 7th or weekly from that very same week as well. Join us next week for more Film Related Fumble. We'll be joined by Doug Liman.
Ooh.
Yeah, director of American Made. I'll be using my patented Liman detector on him just to see whether he's telling the truth.
No.
And Will Poulter, old free-range Poulter, will be in to talk about his new movie, Detroit, as well. So all very, very exciting, isn't it? Right, so that is it. And that is it. Until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from James.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to go on hiatus for a couple of months until my leg gets better.
What, really? No.
No, I'm not.
Oh.
I'm not. It's just a thing I said.
Oh, okay.
I'm off to save up to go to Fat Duck.
There you go.
I'm off to see Groundhog Day in New York before Andy Carl. They shut it down and Andy Carl leaves. And honestly, why did
they're coming to London. We're okay. It'll be fine.
All right. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.